We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.
And welcome to Dads on the Air for this beautiful Tuesday morning in Sydney, and the date is October the 6th, 2009. So welcome to the show. We're going to have some people on from the conference up in Newcastle. That's a men's conference that's going on up there. It's Indigenous Day today, and we hope to have the organisers on there. First of all, we're just going to go to some quick news, and then we'll be back in a moment. So off you go.
Okay. All right. Well, there's a couple of articles in last week's paper that deserve to be mentioned in this particular forum. Caffeine overdose was the heading in last week's Telegraph. Bruce McDougall has written more than three quarters of energy drinks on sale in New South Wales and available to children contain illegal levels of caffeine. New South Wales Food Authority tests on 70 energy drinks revealed 77% had dangerously high levels of caffeine. Primary Industries Minister Ian MacDonald, unfortunate name, MacDonald, ordered the test amid revelations that children had suffered serious side effects, including dizziness, nausea, and heart palpitations after consuming shots of a high caffeine energy drink on the way to school, which is pretty horrible. I don't think we need to comment. It's pretty obvious. Yet another case of the corporations stealing our food chain and putting their right to make profits for their shareholders over the health of our children is another one here, also out of the Telegraph last week, Monday, actually this week. Would you like toy fries with that is the heading. Once every little girl aspired to a toy stove, just like mummy, but a new toy is teaching kids as young as three to ask their friends if they'd like fries with that. The new McKids Play restaurant has alarmed both nutritionalists and consumer groups who fear it may be indoctrinating young children with an unhealthy affection for the Golden Arches. The 30-piece set is being manufactured by Toys R Us brand, shame Toys R Us, and sold in their stores for $130. Experts warned it could soon join toy guns on the list of playthings banned by parents. Well, I'd ban it myself.
Okay, so I'd like to remind everybody they can hear this program later on at www.dadsontheair.net. It's been redesigned recently and looks absolutely wonderful, and some wonderful work by Greg Andreessen, who we're going to be talking to in a moment. I'd just like to introduce everyone in the studio. We've got Phil York from Dads in Distress.
Good morning, John. Good morning, everyone.
Bill Cable.
Good morning, John. It's nice to have a sunny day after all the rain we've had in Sydney lately.
Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Good morning. It wasn't sunny when I arrived here a couple of hours ago. It must have changed.
Myself, John Stapleton. So welcome to everybody. We normally welcome people joining us from around the world, but apparently the live streaming is down at the moment. We apologise to anyone who relies on that, if they can hear us. And we have on the line Greg Andreessen is calling in from the men's conference up in Newcastle. Are you there, Greg?
I am indeed, John. How are you going?
Good. Thanks very much for bringing us live the atmosphere of the conference. What's going on? Can you explain to us all what's happening up there?
Absolutely. Well, Peter van der Voort, as you know, one of the other Dads on the Air team, and myself are up here at the University of Newcastle. And this week, from today through to Friday, we've got 4 days of conference, and it's called the National Men's Health Gathering, and it happens every 2 years, and basically it's a combination of three different events. The first one is the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Male Health Convention, and that's running today and tomorrow. So today's all about Indigenous male health. Tomorrow the National Men's Health Conference starts, and that runs for 3 days, and that's general stuff around men's health. And then on Thursday we have the National Men and Family Relationship Forum, which is talking all about, issues for fathers and all that sort of stuff, which is, sort of more pertinent, I guess, to Dads on the Air. So there's three events all overlapping and, basically talking about blokes and their needs and sort of creating cultures and societies and services that are actually responsive to men's needs as fathers and as partners and as workers and, you know, everything else that men do across life. So it's, you know, it's pretty exciting stuff. Happens every 2 years, and we're going to cover it for Dads on the Air. We've got recording gear up here. We'll record some interviews and put them to air over the coming weeks.
That's great. So can you just describe the atmosphere? What sort of people are attending it?
Well, but today, because it's the Indigenous Male Health Convention, it's mainly black fellas here, so lots of Indigenous guys from all around the country here sort of basically talking about the programs that they might be running in their, you know, part of the country. And obviously it's going to get bigger and better as the week progresses, but at the moment it's mainly Indigenous fellas, and it's a very good turnout. It's the biggest conference yet. These have been running for over 10 years now, and this has got the most delegates or the most attendees of all of them, so it's really building. There's a good article in today's Sydney Morning Herald about the conference, basically talking about the need for men's health to stop blaming men for their own poor health. You often hear these stories, you know, men don't look after themselves, oh, yes. Men don't go to the doctor, men are, you know, eat wrong and they don't exercise and bloody lazy idiots and, you know, all that sort of stuff, which is, you know, so the idea is really to sort of shift that that attitude and actually look at what the government and services can do to actually make them male friendly. So, you know, let's...
I know. Well, yeah, the bloke sitting in a doctor's surgery surrounded by women and kids with all these domestic violence posters portraying them as violent and...
cancer screening and cervical cancer screening, and, you know, he feels like, well, you know, this is a place for women and children, you know. And you know, most men work full-time or overtime, and it's actually much harder for them to get time off work to go to the GP. So it's about, why don't we have more GPs open after hours so that men can attend without having to take time off work, because most guys are, you know, busy earning a living to support their families. So, you know, it's about making them male-friendly, making them open at the right times. And a lot of men work remotely, work out on mining communities or on oil rigs or with the armed forces. They're actually away from home. So, you know, another idea is actually to bring doctors to the workplace, and, you know, so that, bring doctors to the men so that the individual men don't have to sort of travel out to see a GP, but they're actually, you know, tailoring them. But it's much more than medicine and health. It's looking at services for dads, so that, you know, when you go along to you're about to have a baby, you go onto a hospital. It's not just about mum and breastfeeding and stuff, but you actually get taken aside and with the other new dads and learn about the changes that for you as in your role as a father, adjusting your work and, you know, adjusting to having a new baby and, you know, feeding the baby at night and all that stuff, which is new when a baby arrives, and, you know, so that dads are actually prepared for big changes that come along when they become fathers. So,
it's a huge change in a lot of blokes' lives, and a lot of blokes do report being very bewildered and confused by the changes that have been suddenly forced upon them in their life, if you like.
That's right. And with the woman, she's actually the one pregnant, so she's had 9 months sort of, you know, adjusting and preparing, and her body's changing. And for the dad, it's like once that baby's born, suddenly, boom, everything changes, you know.
Everything changes, yeah.
Exactly. So it's about actually, you know, giving the men the information they need in advance so that it's not such a shock when the baby arrives. And, you know, then there's the old issue of domestic violence. There's a dozen sessions about that. And so it's actually looking at approaches where, that we're not just looking at male perpetrators, hopefully, but looking at all perpetrators of violence. But then for those men that are violent in their relationships, looking at all of the causes that might be contributing to that. So not just going on about this cliche of, you know, men are, you know, violence is the way that men sort of assert their patriarchal authority in a patriarchal world and, you know, that nonsense. But, you know, let's look at the context of the violence and of their lives, and maybe there's alcohol involved, maybe they have mental health issues. maybe they were abused as children. You know, maybe they grew up in a family where they saw, you know, dad hitting mum, and so they think that that's, you know, the way that you solve problems. I mean, there's a whole lot of
issues. Look at the use or abuse of statistics, particularly by government agencies?
Yes. There's a number of presentations that'll be looking at that issue. I'm going to be there sort of sticking my hand up, because, as you know, recently the New South Wales government, South Australian government, federal government have all this year been putting out, you know, big, glossy reports on domestic violence, channeling tens of millions of dollars into it. And it's all based on fake statistics. These lies that 95% of domestic violence is perpetrated by men, and that domestic violence is the greatest cause of death for young women, and, you know, none of these are true.
And the one in three statistic that you see so often, that is a complete and total lie. Is that your view?
Absolutely. Well, what they do, they take a survey that finds that over the entire lifespan of a woman's life, one in three women is in their entire life experiences one incident in their entire life of a threat or an insult or a attempt, as well as actual violence. And so we find from this one in three women over their lifetime having, you know, maybe someone shoved them once. I mean, you know, this is a normal thing for any human.
And if you ask the same question of men, you get exactly the same result.
Well, you find a lot more men. You find one in two men say yes to that, as opposed to one in three women. So, and then from that, suddenly that turns into domestic violence. And so you have people like the Federal Sex Discrimination Commissioner coming on TV saying that one in three women is a victim of domestic violence. So they actually, with just a little shift of the language, corrects that, turns into an absolutely fabricated factoid, which then paints one in three Australian men as violent abusers, which is not the case. It's a fraction of 1% of men may be violent in their relationships when you look at the actual research. So we'll be exploring some of those things and challenging some of those myths as well.
It is astonishing that that governments have been allowed to get away with stirring up such a frenzy in the community over this issue. It's astonishingly dishonest.
Absolutely, and you know, there's a few people out there trying to keep them honest, but they seem to be very good at getting away with it. And
Boils down to money, doesn't it? A lot of people are making a living out of it.
Millions and
millions of dollars.
Well, it's an industry, as we've covered. You know, we've had Michael Woods on the program before, and you know, talking about it, it really is an industry. When you're pumping $44 million this year into it, I mean, that's going into the pockets of a lot of people who are making their living out of it. So, you know, it's in their vested interest to keep these myths going, and so that they can get their slice of the pie. And, you know, of course, we all recognise that the genuine victims of violence, whether they're male or female, you know, deserve services and support and you know, the proper police response, etc., if it's appropriate. But to overinflate statistics to infer that, you know, that one in three women is being abused when she goes home, and that sort of one in three men behind closed doors is sort of, you know, battering their wives. You know, I mean, imagine we said that about any other group. Imagine we inferred that, you know, that one in three, you know, Aboriginal men were sort of, you know, wife beaters or Jews, or take any other group and, you know, put this slander on them, and there'd be an absolute outrage. But because it's men, you know, it's like an open license, really.
One of the interesting things the Sex Discrimination Commissioner found in a recent tour of the country was that a lot of Aboriginal women were saying that there's a plethora of programs for women out in remote Australia, but absolutely none for the menfolk, and that the men that they love in their lives, their sons and brothers and husbands, are completely ignored in government programs. Is that something that will be addressed today in the Indigenous issue, do you think, in the Indigenous sessions?
Well, I think that's certainly something that will be being called for. In fact, we just had Dr. Mick Adams was giving the first keynote, and that was one of his big points. Was basically, you know, Aboriginal men have been neglected when it comes to funding and services. And you're absolutely right. The Sex Discrimination Commissioner went to a remote community and went to the women's group, of course. And she didn't go to the men's group. And was sort of taken aback when the Aboriginal women all said, when she said, look, what are your needs? They all said, we want something for our men. There's nothing for the men out here. And, you know, this is... So, absolutely, I think that's on the agenda today. And also this demonising of Aboriginal men is because of the intervention in Central Australia, Northern Australia. Aboriginal men have been painted as with this broad brush that they're all sort of, by inference, they're sort of child abusers and domestically violent. And that's a big issue.
An alcoholic.
And that's a big issue for a lot of the guys here. It's like this stigma attached to Aboriginal men because of this intervention. So, really? There'll be a lot of talk about that as well.
And a lot of this harm is being done at taxpayers' expense. This demonisation of Aboriginal men. Taxpayers paying for it.
Well, that's it. Yeah, absolutely. And so, where's the funding for Aboriginal men's groups? There are community Aboriginal men's groups running on smell of an oily rag all over the country. None of them are getting a cent of government funding, and that should be where the resources are being put to give Aboriginal men, restore their role in their communities and give them, a sense of dignity and a sense of control and purpose over their lives that has been lost or taken away since the white men arrived. And basically, that's been eroded, and these men are getting together to restore that sense of male roles and male leadership, and yet there's not a set of funding going into these groups. So, it's hopefully the government will sit up and take notice. The Labor government certainly seems to have been particularly bad at funding things, services for men, but they do seem to be quite good at addressing the needs of, well, they say that they care much more about Aboriginal needs than say the Howard government did. So it's possible that through their lip service to caring about Aboriginal people, some of that money might go to Aboriginal men, even though the government seems to be fairly anti-male in a lot of other respects. So we'll see, I guess.
We shall see. We're hoping to get Ashley Gordon on, the organiser of the Indigenous section. How's that shaping up?
Well, Peter's now run off to try and grab him, so... maybe we might want to go to a music track.
Yeah, we'll go to a music track and
we'll see whether we can get Ashley on.
Have some look.
Fingers crossed.
That'll be great. Look, thank you so much for coming on and bringing us live from the men's conference up there in Newcastle. Thank you so much. That was Greg Andreessen, who's been a wonderful addition to Dads on the Air and done a wonderful job with the website as well. So we'll be back in a moment. This is the almost world premiere of Psycho Schizo Babe.
I'm grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Dads on the Air, this is Bill Cable, and I'm in the studio with Philip York, Ian Purdy and John Stanley. On the line we have Ray Kelly, who's at the conference in Newcastle. We were just talking a few minutes ago. Ray, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Ray, I wonder if you could just tell our listeners something about the opening of the conference. I think you made the official opening, and I wonder if you could just tell us some of the points you covered in that opening.
Sure. Look, basically, the acknowledgement of country was primarily what I was here for, but in hoping to try and set some groundwork for the work that's going to be done over the next couple of days, I was talking about the role and responsibility of Indigenous men in communities, about how and ways in which we might begin to start to provide opportunities for men to begin to start to take leadership roles in communities. And basically I'm talking about historical, cultural research can provide frameworks for that leadership into the future.
And what's your background, Ray, then, in this area?
Well, I've worked in community health services for quite a number of years, but during the last couple of years I've actually been enrolled in completing a PhD at the Newcastle University through the Wallatooka Institute, which is an Indigenous institute as a part of the Newcastle University itself. And my work now is dealing with historical language types, and also on other data that provides for me a framework in which I see leadership. Clearly, there was a notion of citizenship and leadership through traditional structures such as the initiation processes, and the higher learning, particularly for men as they get older, obviously.
Yes, I think the Indigenous language program has been in the news a little bit lately, with the Northern Territory government restricting it to, I think, a couple of hours a day. Is that going to be discussed at the conference, do you think?
I would imagine there will be a range of things that are happening over the next couple of days, and I would imagine that will probably be one of the issues that may come up. The other thing is about the way in which governments are not seeing the issues that are emerging from communities, and so we're also talking about ways in which people might, I'm talking participants at this gathering, may find ways to develop some of the approaches that might see government take a second look at any of the changes that may come from or into the programs that are currently being administered through various departments, obviously.
Yes, and I guess a big part of that is the intervention, and whether that's had a good effect or a bad effect. Have you got any views on that?
I don't have enough history and understanding of it on the ground, and so I'm reluctant to provide commentary on that. But what I will do is say that there are a number of people here from the Northern Territory who will give, I got no doubt, who will give an account about what's happening. My concern for any or government intervention does, in fact, can remove people from a leadership role. Now, I'll be happy to discuss that with any of the participants here to see whether or not that participation in terms of leadership is in fact a part of the government's agenda. If it isn't, then what's likely to happen is that we're back to step one, square one again, where people are waiting for the latest decision making, the latest funding opportunities, and what happens is people will roll with the punches. What we're talking about is taking a leadership role and saying, okay, what are those things that are most important in our communities, And one of the things that seems to be emerging thus far is this sense of community consultation, and also about good communication across the country. Obviously, people who do have good programs, we want to know about those so that we might be able to, multiply that around the country.
A bit of cross-fertilisation. We're talking with Ray Kelly at the Men's Health Conference in Newcastle. Ray, I wonder if you could tell us something about some of the other speakers who'll be on stage in the next day.
Well, we had... let me just go through the program here real quickly. I'm sorry. I'm sort of getting up to date real quick with it. Mick Adams provided the keynote address this morning, and, very well received, talking about the prevalence of diabetes, obviously providing information about life expectancy isn't news to Indigenous Australians, particularly at this conference. But what he's talking about is about taking a leadership role in terms of research. Now, that's quite exciting because we have numerous young men from, a number of the community sectors, particularly AMSs and the likes. And if there's an inspiration for those young men to maybe then, rejoin the education system or research, develop research projects in their community, then we have a leadership role once again, other than, providing the latest youth program. So I'm very excited by that. You've got a number of people from all around the country who are bringing advice and showcasing their work in their community. So there are too numerous here to mention just the amount of people. But the ministers, Mr. Snowden's coming tomorrow, which will be exciting. Sorry, the print's too small here, mate.
Yeah, that's okay. So did you say the minister? Is that the state minister, is it?
I'm not sure. Snowden, Minister Snowden, let me see where he is.
He's federal.
He's federal, is he?
Thanks, John.
Sorry, mate. Yeah, this print is just way too small for me to read. I'm trying to read off a program here, and it's been downloaded, so it's even smaller than the original. Yes, it's so there were quite a number of people who are here who will be providing. I'm really keen to know what people are doing in their communities. So we've got people representing from all states and territories here.
Well, that was Ray Kelly, who introduced the Indigenous stream of the conference. Thank you so much for coming on to Dad's on the Air.
All the very best to you guys. Like you, we are keen to provide leadership roles and provide good services through our Indigenous men's networks.
And if you just had to sum it up before you go, the major issues that are facing Indigenous men in this country, they die considerably younger than the whiteys. What? How would you put it?
I would put it down to leadership. Citizenship and leadership. We cannot just continue to see ourselves as that, the downsides of health affairs in this country. We have to begin to start to see ourselves as healthy communities. And indeed, for men, we need to see ourselves in positive roles. And that's what I'm hoping will emerge from the gathering.
And what's your view about the intervention? Has that helped portray Indigenous men as in very poor light?
Well, no, I don't think that it's done any good from that point of view. Now, what I can't do is I can't divorce myself from realities in communities, but it's about the way in which that information, I believe, was abused and used as a political tool earlier on. My understanding is that, people in the territory had been for quite a number of years, hollering and screaming to government, saying that we need to have, the appropriate support in communities. Now, if that wasn't forthcoming at that time, and now it is seen as a necessary movement because we cannot We cannot develop programs or create the type of community action in our own communities, then it seems to me that what we're again left with is this perception that Indigenous people cannot handle their own affairs. Now, what we're hoping to do is to try and assist people to take up that gauntlet, to take up that challenge, and to once again become a part of that policy development and obviously service delivery.
And to become proud, noble people once again.
Well, I think that we always were, and I think that that's again one of those sad perceptions that sometimes becomes the cultural reality is that people go, well, I have nothing, so my cup's half empty. My cup's half full. Yeah. Really, we need to begin to start to see ourselves as having a cup that's half full and going, okay, how do I gain these other skills? And if I don't have them, how do I get them? Now, that's what we're talking about in terms of leadership, being taking up the challenge to become a part of that cultural change.
And is there any final words you'd like to say?
No, as I said just before, I'm really looking forward to positive outcomes. I'm looking forward to people taking leadership roles and developing the, certainly from a research point of view, I'm hoping that people will start to see themselves as a part of the cure. And that cure is about, providing good, sound information and education in the communities and then assisting people to find ways out of that, those social, the downsides in our community affairs.
We've been speaking with Ray Kelly. He just introduced the Indigenous stream of the men's conference up there in Newcastle. Thank you so much for coming on to Dads on the Air.
All the very best.
No, thank you. Bye-bye. We'll be back in a moment.
And welcome back. That was a wonderful interview there with the guys up there in Newcastle, and we look forward to hearing more about their week up there in the coming weeks here on Dad's on the Air. Back to the news. A story in The Australian in Saturday by Nicola Berkovic. The headline reads, Top Court Eyes Joint Care for Parents. The High Court has agreed to hear an appeal into whether it is reasonably practical to force a mother to stay in a remote mining town in Western Queensland so her ex-husband could have equal custody of their daughter. Now, we've reported on this particular story ourselves over the time. You may remember it. This is a case where the couple lived in Sydney for about 7 years before moving to this town in Western Queensland. 6 months later, they found themselves separated, went to the Federal Magistrates Court and the Family Court. There was a decision by the Family Court that the mother should stay with the daughter in this town due to an equal and shared parenting responsibility, and found that it was indeed in the best interest of the child. It was then put up to the Federal Magistrates Court, who actually upheld the decision through the appeal process from the Family Court, and now it's now gone to the High Court. Arguing on behalf of the father, Barrister Graham Page said the High Court should not hear the appeal because the lower courts had already decided equal shared parenting was in the best interest of the child. And if the mother was to move away, obviously the daughter would be separated from the father, and they believed that the mother would not promote the child's relationship with the father. Arguing on the mother's side, her barrister Louise Goldchild, great name, oh sorry, Goodchild, even better name, said that the lower courts had failed to consider the real nuts and bolts of the shared parenting order, which had the effect of forcing the mother to live on welfare in a remote town where she could not find a job. Well, you know, she probably couldn't find a job down here in Sydney either at the moment. And, you know, it all comes back to this particular point that, you know, what is in the best interest of this particular little girl? You know, the Family Court already says that it's in the best interest to have a relationship with both parents. The Federal Magistrates Court has agreed that it is in the best interest of the child to have a relationship with both the parents. It now goes to the High Court, and the argument is no longer whether it is in the best interest of the child. The argument is now, is it reasonably practical?
And Bill, do you have any views on this matter?
Yes, well, I think when people talk about what's in the best interest of the child, it sort of begs the question, as that's exactly what we're trying to find out, what is in the best interest of the child. And as Phil mentioned, the legislation, the courts are saying that the best interests of the child are when they get to know both parents. And I think we tend to get sidetracked onto thinking that the best interest of the child might be to stay with one parent, sometimes the mother, often the mother, rather than that that relationship with the both parents. But there are a whole lot of other factors that you need to go the extra step rather than just saying, oh, whatever's in the best interest of the child.
Whatever that means. Mm. It usually means whatever the judge or the psych or whoever wants it to mean.
Very
or
subjective
the government
judgment.
Of the day. That's totally right. Subjective judgment. And usually made with a lot of bias and a lot of agendas hidden within it.
You know, it's obviously a really tough story, but, you know, at the end of the day, they went up there as a family to, you know, build on what they were as that relationship was. And, you know, just because it's separated, does it mean that that child has to suffer? I don't think so.
Well, it's an incredibly significant case because there are thousands upon thousands of people in this situation. And
that's it. You know, Mum wasn't dragged up there kicking and screaming, saying, no, I don't want to go there.
Mm, true enough. Mm. So we shall see.
Yes, I think I agree with you, John. These relocation cases are, well, very difficult. There are a lot of them, and if we can get some good guidance from the High Court, it'll be very valuable, I think.
Well, whether or not it's good guidance from the High Court, so,
I can only hope.
Different question altogether. Mm-hmm. Not that we're going to slag off the High Court today.
We'll leave that for another day.
Oh, dear, oh, dear.
And we have another story here, Bill.
One from the Telegraph about not-so-happy families, and this is a story that probably not surprising to a lot of people, but nevertheless there seems to have generated a fair bit of interest, and I'm talking about the separation of Greg Norman and his wife, Chris Evatt. Not much came out initially. It was just to say that they decided to separate and that there was going to be no further comment, but a few issues seem to have arisen in the last few days, and one of them is that there seems to have been some antagonism between Chris Evatt, the new wife, and Greg Norman's children, Morgan, 26, and Greg, 23. Greg Norman has been portrayed by a number of people as being a devoted dad, and apparently when the tension arose between his children and the new wife, that was one of the factors that might have led to the decision to separate. So it's interesting to see these issues affecting everybody, and well, we can only hope that the relationship between the parents and the children manages to survive this high-profile separation that we read about in the paper every day.
We're going to a music break. We'll be back in a moment.
In distress, meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Yes, and this morning's Telegraph, pages 2 and 3, there's a plethora of articles about little girls, special investigation, they're claiming. Gemma Jones is the main journalist involved in preparing these pieces. Toddlers want bras, preteens want wax, is one of the headings of one of the columns. Gemma Jones has written, researcher Maggie Hamilton spent a year speaking to thousands of parents, teachers and children, and I can vouch for that. She spoke to me. I took part in her interview as a father. Gemma Jones goes on to write, her findings have uncovered a daunting list of milestones for young girls. Ms. Hamilton found that girls wanted to go to preschool and kindergarten in bras tailored for toddlers, paint their nails and wear lip gloss. By the age of 6, girls are accessorizing with handbags and branded clothes. By 8 and 9, they diet and style their hair. At age 10 and 11, some girls are getting their first Brazilian wax and are holding birthday parties for their friends in beauty salons. We're seeing an increasing number of mums allowing little girls, as soon as they get their periods, to get Brazilian waxes, Miss Hamilton said. We're talking 10 and 11. At the age of 13, Miss Hamilton said, girls are sexting, compromising pictures of themselves to boys and engaging in oral sex. By the age of 14, teachers have told Ms. Hamilton some girls have had 20 sexual partners by the age of 14. Good Lord. We are getting sexting in primary schools, girls sending topless photographs of themselves and so on, she said. We're not talking about short skirts and cleavage. We've gone way beyond that. Yeah, this is all pretty disturbing stuff for parents of young girls. I mean, for parents of young boys as well. I mean, this obviously won't be impacting well on the young boys. It goes on in this plethora of articles. Another one, little girls, the new sex object. Preschoolers turning themselves into sexualized mini adults by wearing bras, nail polish and lipstick are requiring psychological help in increasing numbers. Child development experts said young girls were now entering their tween years between being a child and a teenager at the tender age of 6, 5 years earlier than previously. Experts said that by the age of 6, girls needed branded clothes. At 7, they wanted stylized hair. By 8, they were beginning diets, etc., etc. The Daily Telegraph yesterday found crop top style bras for toddlers aged 2 to 3 on sale at a major department store, sparking outrage amongst parents. The alarming trend is taking a heavy psychological toll. Professor of Development Psychiatry at Monash University, Louise Newman, said, I've seen children suffering from clinical depression in primary school because they don't feel they are pretty enough or thin enough to be able to be popular. The girls are worried they won't get boyfriends. Girls have started defining their self-worth in terms of themselves as sex objects, which is absolutely tragic, you've really got to say. Dr. Joe Tushy, the CEO of the Australian Childhood Foundation, said unprecedented numbers of young children needed psychological help. In an unprecedented way, this generation of children are being exposed to adult concepts far earlier than they are ready to understand. He said kids as young as 7 are worried about the way they look and whether they're attractive to boys. They lack the lack of self-esteem and confidence. If they don't feel they are fit, that they fit into those messages, they feel like they're not as good as other kids. An impact is depression and anxiety, which we are seeing as an increase at unprecedented levels. This is horrifying stuff. This is a case of basically allowing the corporations into advertising on television and shoving unreal body images, or this is one of the results. Counselling for the young sexually abused appears, another article here. Children as young as 7 are enrolled in programs counselling them about their inappropriate sexual behaviour towards other children. The Australian Childhood Foundation treats 150 children a year displaying such alarming behaviour. The Foundation's Dr. Joe Tucci said children were sexually abusing each other without realising what they were doing. Dr. Tucci blamed the sexual images children are now bombarded with for the staggering rise in kids, particularly those who have never been sexually abused themselves, assaulting their classmates. The factor behind it is that kids are being exposed to those kinds of sexual imagery without understanding it, Dr. Tucci said. They don't understand what they are doing. They don't understand the consequences of it. Inappropriate behavior range from exposing themselves, inappropriately touching themselves in front of other children, and using items to sexually assault young girls. I mean, all this is pretty horrifying stuff. Anybody?
It is, mate. Very horrifying.
And, yeah. Maggie Hamilton's got stuff to say on this as well, hasn't she?
Well, she did. Ms. Hamilton said focused and effective pressures from advertising and marketing experts had made girls into a shopping force. Since she wrote the book What's Happening to Our Girls, Ms. Hamilton has been travelling New South Wales and the country giving talks. She said the overt sexualisation of young girls was leading them into sexual behaviour, which is at a far too young age, which is completely inappropriate. They don't know what they're doing. They're just imitating what they see on television. It's a case of you know, advertising, you know, pushing all these products. One of the main offenders in this, let me just have a look, Target. Child advocate Julie Gale was outraged to find bras for toddlers on sale at stores including Target. Target defended the sale yesterday, arguing it was up to parents to choose.
Exactly.
Put it on the parents. Haven't we got enough to deal with?
Exactly.
Without these bloody department stores waving stupid things in front of our children, advertising them to them. I mean, you know, this is...
You can't legislate on everything.
No, true. But, you know, my other question is, you know, out of all these studies... Is there a section in that study that shows whether that child came from a separated parents or whether they lived in an intact family, you know? Or
whether they had a father present.
That's it. Exactly, you know, or whether mum's just, you know, doing the best she can and going out and buying what she thinks is good for her daughters or her sons. And, you know, we all make mistakes, but geez.
Well, look, the consequences are reverberating around society. I mean... What was it, Jeff Kennett and the Beyond Blue, they're doing a survey to try and find out why so many preschoolers and preteens are presenting themselves at primary school with depression and neuroses and psychoses. It's happening at a younger age. I mean, the reason is it goes back to, I think, allowing advertising in children's, you know, on children's television and presenting these images and, you know, McDonald's and unhealthy food options and the whole gambit of allowing the corporations. I mean, we've basically given the corporations the right to put their shareholders' profit above the well-being, nutrition and mental health of our children. And this is what we're getting. This is the result. Is that we're getting little girls at 5, 6, 7 thinking that they have to be like Pamela Anderson or somebody or Paris Hilton, the great role models that they get. And presenting.
Paris Hilton's gone quiet, hasn't she?
Didn't she just recently say that she thought everybody in LA was nuts and it was a jungle and wild and it was too terrible for her and she was going back to the country or something silly?
Really? She noticed, did she? Wow. Okay, well, we hope to have Maggie Hamilton on next week to discuss these things. Not that she knows yet, but we'll ask her. And she's been a regular guest on the program. She wrote a really wonderful book, What Men Don't Talk About, I think was the title, which was a really fascinating, particularly from a woman author. It was a really extremely interesting book, and she's a really extremely interesting author, and... we've had her on before, and hopefully we'll have her on again. And she's just written a book about young girls, so that will also be a really interesting interview.
We'll get her on this. There's one more article here, if you don't mind, John.
We'll go to a quick break after that.
Okay, I'll get this out quickly. Lauren Dixon has written, Kids' Parties Take On a New Face. Once upon a time, the simple joy of a child's birthday party was about... the pass, the parcel, and the lolly bags. But now, girls as young as 5 are being taught how to apply makeup and strut like a model. Nadia Burke runs educational makeup parties for girls aged between 7 and 13. Generally, the average age is about 9 or 10, says Ms. Burke, the owner of Chic Petite Makeup and Pamper Parties. We do makeup kits for each girl. I teach them how to put on the basics and the different types of makeup worn for television and film. With the younger parties, we do a combination of half makeup and half games, as long as it's light and it's fun and it's okay. But I just don't think they understand what the sexualizing of young women, young girls, is leading on to. It's not good, I don't believe.
We'll be back in a moment.
I gave her my love. to have my children near? Do they think that I could take it? Do they think it doesn't matter? Do they think that because I'm a man that somehow won't shut up?
So fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in Distress. 1-300-853-437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
And we have Geoffrey Green, President of the Shared Parenting Council of Australia. You there?
Yes, good morning, John.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air.
Thank you, good to be back.
Now, what's been going on in the whole arena of family law reform in Australia?
Well, there's a bit of activity lately, John. Of course, all pointing for, directions the wrong way. There's been a Solicitor General's report recently released that we're still going through and we'll respond to formally, but essentially saying that in family separation cases, judges are taking inadequate attention to situations of violence. Now, we're yet to see the empirical evidence that supports that view, and we don't believe for a minute that a judge whose primary responsibility above all else is the welfare and benefit of a child that will put a child in such a risky position. And we would never support a child being put at risk, and we don't believe the courts are. So at this point in time, that's again another a report that's trying to paint a picture that the family law is not working on the basis that children are exposed to risk, but yet the evidence doesn't quite yet support such a position.
And so who are the authors of that?
As a Solicitor General's report, I actually don't have it with me at the moment, John, but it's something that we've got a hold of, or our office has got a hold of, and we'll be responding to it publicly.
And so this is really a part of a quite an elaborate agenda, isn't it, to wind back what we always regarded as fairly modest reforms. And as you know, we were fairly critical here that it didn't go far enough. But in retrospect, they look fairly miraculous.
Well, look, in with the state of play and the type of inquiries and the type of agencies getting involved, they're what we used to colloquially call, John, prior to the 2006 reforms, the family misery industry. What we're seeing is a concerted effort to bring back relevance for themselves at the expense of families and children and couples who are separating. Now, laws should never be made for the extreme. While provisions should be allowed judges to deal with the extreme, laws should be provided to suit the average everyday circumstance. And the average everyday circumstance is a situation where children have grown up with both parents, their parents have separated, and then they want to continue that relationship as best they can with both their parents. And that's what the family law regime is all about now. It's appropriate. It's the right answer. All of the evidence supports that children do best when they keep a relationship or a maximised relationship with both their parents as best as they can. And we do not support going back to the bad old days.
And it's an incredibly reactionary backlash, isn't it, by defenders of what was then the status quo that we're seeing. It's really quite an elaborate and concerted effort.
Well, there's a lot of shrill in relation to it, John, and I think that's quite interesting to watch. Claiming that you know, parents are now, or mothers particularly, are unable to voice their concerns about violent circumstances for fear of losing their children, are completely unfounded and actually defy any common sense and should not be. I mean, I can't believe that they're being raised by some of the institutions that are raising such concerns. If there are issues in relation to how the legal system, including the lawyers and the children's reps and the family report writers and the courts, are dealing with matters of separation or matters that involve violence, well, then it sounds like there seems, if anything, there needs to be some education process for those practitioners. But there is no chance that we can see or have ever seen a court defiantly putting a child at risk for some ideological or what they believe is some legal purpose, because the Act certainly does not provide for that. The Family Law Act does not provide a circumstance where a judge must put a child at risk in any circumstance. And judges do a very good job in being able to determine these things. If there are circumstances that, in a very small... we need to put this in context, John, that we're talking about a very minute amount of cases where these circumstances may arise. The overwhelming majority of cases do not have circumstances that involve violence or circumstances that may restrict or could cause an order to restrict contact with children. So in that context, we think that the courts have got the correct processes and the capacities to put in place, including appointment of children's representatives, children's lawyers, including the appointment of family report writers and counsellors to determine the circumstances of the children. And after all of those processes, the courts are making findings that the children should see both parents, well, then it would show to me that those cases don't have any other possible legitimate concern that satisfied A, a family court reporter, B, a children's lawyer, or C, a judge.
So in conjunction with the this backlash that we're seeing, a very reactionary backlash it is, the domestic violence industry has been very, very lively as well, with lots of claims coming out that that women are being subjected to abuse at Wine Free, women are the subject of domestic violence and so on, using what many critics regard as highly inflated statistics or just factoids. They're just simply wrong. What do you see as the politics behind all of this?
Well, we have experienced those, you know, misuse of statistics or inflated statistics for many, many years. Definitions become the problem primarily in response to what is constituted abuse. And unfortunately, it's only ever seen one way. For example, if the husband gets up in the morning and reads the paper while he's having breakfast and doesn't speak to his wife, I've seen circumstances where that's been described as abuse.
Yes, there was one study showed that 7% of people think that that is domestic violence.
That's right. So this is where the statistics are inflated, but without credibility. And unfortunately, the problem when, you know, an industry such as the family misery industry, as we call it, engage in a process to attempt to inflate statistics, what they actually do is demean the actual real circumstances of families that, where there is genuine violence and abuse matters that should be dealt with and attended to. And I think it does them a grave disservice while they're trying to expand their own interests. And that's a big concern, has been a big concern, not just to us at the Shared Parenting Council, but certainly to many politicians. And these issues have been discussed at length in Parliament. These people need to take account of all of these things and start, you know, if they want to have solutions, societal solutions put in place for these issues, then they need to be factual about the circumstances that they're actually trying to sort out.
Now, there has been articles suggesting that the Labor Party is hostage to particular women's groups, and that this is one of the factors behind this reversal of what were such common sense reforms. Would you comment on that?
Oh, look, I think there's no doubt that having had a extensive public inquiries, some of the largest in the Parliament's history on these issues of family law reform, including taking witnesses and evidence all around Australia, from the House, both the House of Representatives inquiry and then subsequently from the Senate inquiry, making findings and recommendations which were actually above and beyond the reforms that were ultimately implemented. On a bipartisan level, it seems sort of to defy logic that that the Labor Party would be offering any sort of comfort to these people, other than perhaps in the potential of building a coalition of discontent. But the facts are that these determinations in family law, and have always been, when it comes to matters of family law, been determined on a bipartisan basis. So. This isn't a Liberal Labor issue, and I'm not in any way convinced that the radical feminist groups have got a significant influence within the Labor Party wholly. I think the Labor Party, if anything, has a focus. It would be the trade union movement would be the primary focus of the Labor Party, and I don't believe that the radical feminist groups would have more sway or more track than the. In the trade union movement.
Well, apart from Sharon Burrows, who of course is the head of the ACTU, that you would find that it's a very live issue amongst trade unionists, particularly the conduct of the Child Support Agency, for instance, is a very live issue on many a workplace around the country.
Well, absolutely. We, over the course of the many years the Shed Parent Council has been going, we have had approaches from heads of trade unions, making representations about their own constituency, who believe they have been, badly served by the systems in place and were fully supportive of the reforms that the last government put in place. So, and they're very powerful, and they're very powerful within the Labor Party, in a block. In fact, many of those trade unions have the power to put members of parliament in or out of parliament. That's how powerful they are. So, it beggars belief that the Labor Party would be looking at stamping on its own constituency in such a way for a very small and minute, splinter group who really have no credibility or any evidence to support what they're after.
I know, and it's a simple thing, isn't it? Most blokes want to see their kids, whether they're married or not, and most kids want to see their dads, whether they live together or not. It's pretty simple.
Oh, it's very simple. You can try and sort of, sometimes it reminds me of those old snow cones that you see in tourist shops where you shake up a snow cone and all you can see is snow everywhere in the liquid and you can't see the issue behind it. When you let it all settle, it's a very, very simple issue. And as you have quite rightly put, it's about children's rights and desires to have a relationship with both their mother and father, and that our system needs to encourage that as best it can in the circumstances of parents separating.
Well, you just stay there. We're going to a quick song, and then we'll be back. We're talking with Geoffrey Green. He's the current president of the Shared Parenting Council of Australia. We'll be back in a moment.
She wakes up early every morning. She gets up long before the sunshine. Greets the milkman who's still yawning. And reads the paper for a short time. Calls the kids, get out of bed. They never hear a word she says. Husband stands to leave the table. She says, I hope you have a good day. He thinks one day soon as I'm able, I'll get a job where I get good pay. They find it hard to make ends meet, but they don't mention it because they have each other. Is free while they're supposed to be too young to be married.
to be married. But what can they do? They were gonna have a baby.
Talking with Geoffrey Green, he's the current president of the Shared Parenting Council of Australia. Welcome back.
Yes, thank you, John.
Now, look, what can people do if they're concerned about this, that they're worried that they won't be able to see their kids anymore and that the legislation is going to change and that, you know, most people these days, rightly or wrongly, expect to be able to not just see, but to be able to directly care for their kids after separation. That's become the cultural norm quite quickly. What can people do?
Well, John, family law is an issue that affects every Australian. Whether you've been directly involved in a case yourself by separation, which is, you know, quite likely in the circumstances of almost one in two divorces of every marriage, whether you have a friend, a brother, a relative, sister, who's been engaged or involved in family law, or whether you as a child have been, you know, raised from divorced parents, it's an issue that permeates throughout society, and it's an extremely significant issue that every Australian has a right to have a say about. And what I say to those people is if you want to have your say, use your democratic rights to write to your Member of Parliament. You all have a local Member of Parliament. You all have local senators. In fact, every Australian has 12 senators in the states and 2 senators in each of the territories, as well as a local federal Member of Parliament, and get on, you know, pen to paper and write them a letter and voice your concerns.
And in many ways, sorry, a letter is better form, isn't it? Because they're more or less duty bound to respond. It puts it on the record.
That's right. Puts it on the record. And you've got a right to communicate your views on these issues with your Member of Parliament. That's what they're there for. You've elected them to represent you in Parliament. They've been elected. They're in the Parliament. Have them represent you. So the best thing that anybody can do is put pen to paper, contact their local Member of Parliament, make an appointment, go and see them, speak to all of their senators. They're all in the telephone book. They're easy to find. And make those representations and ensure that their Members of Parliament are appraised of the views of their own constituency, of which you, as a member of Australian society, are.
Look, one of the things that springs to mind is the media was very much behind, very surprisingly really, was very much behind the Howard reforms. They weren't particularly great supporters of the Howard government, but they were very much behind these reforms, and some of the toughest women journalists in the country, Madonna King and in Brisbane, for instance, who you would know, and Paola Totterer, for instance, in Sydney, very, very tough journalists, wrote very supportive articles of shared parenting. How do you think the media is treating it this time around?
Well, I don't believe that's changed. I mean, if you want to look at the flagship newspaper editorial position in The Australian just a couple of weeks ago, where they said that, now is not the time to go back to the dark days. If there are any, minor amendments around the edges that need fixing or fine-tuning, well, that's something we should, have a debate about and determine whether that is, in fact, the case, and if so, fix it. But other than that, the system is a much better system, and the media support that. There are a couple of journalists who are, essentially captured by this, the end of the world is nigh argument, but it's only a shrill group, really. The overwhelming majority of the media, editorial coverage from, almost all of the newspapers around Australia continues to be in support of the reforms that were put through.
And in the cold light of day, do you think it will happen?
Oh, look, in the end, there is nothing more emotive in a legal context than family law. And on that basis, I think we need to expect a little bit of more emotional responses than you would normally expect in a political debate. Putting that aside, those determinations ultimately need to be considered in the context of how I said that this affects every Australian and has a major impact on society, both the future well-being of children and the next generation of children that we're bringing into the world, and the capacity for those parents to get on with their lives after what can only be described as one of the most traumatic events in their life would be a parental separation. So I believe that ultimately the Parliament will temper the emotions of this debate, and the facts will be on the table. And then when the facts are on the table, and that's the basis of which a determination will be made by the Parliament, I expect there'll be very little change, if any, to the current arrangements.
So there's an old political saying, never hold an inquiry unless you know the answer. Do you think that, I think there's three separate inquiries into family law going on at this point, from the Institute of Family Studies, from Justice Chisholm, who was a former family court judge, and another one that I can't even think of.
Well, the family report, Justice Chisholm, and I can't think of the other one either. having said that, I think that that's all well and good. It's the Parliament who will decide to if there's any changes that need to be made on this. There has never been family law reform in the history of this country that was not bipartisan. In these circumstances, we have the Shadow Attorney General, Senator George Brandis, who has announced the Coalition's position in relation to this, and that is as they are vehemently opposed to any mass reform on the basis of the sort of shrill that's been sort of placed out there in the media of recent weeks and months. They support the reforms that were made previously. So, and of course, the independent senators as well are holding a position at this point in time supporting the previous decisions made. So it would not appear that there is parliamentary support for reform. Certainly there's no evidence to establish any support for reform at this point in time.
We're out of time.
So I'm looking forward to that evidence being on the table, John, and then we can all sit down and see, well, let's see what they're really talking about and put a proper viewpoint to the people of Australia.
So we're out of time. Thank you so much for coming on the show. That was Geoffrey Green, from the President of the Shared Parenting Council of Australia. Lovely to have you back on to Dad's on the Air. We'll be back next week. Don't forget, you can listen to this program and all our previous programs at dadsontheair.net. So we'll be back next week.
We ask all the questions that others don't.